Hello, my name is Rebecca Tapp, and this is the DNA of Purpose podcast, proudly brought to you by the team at Future Crunch.
Everything that goes out is affecting something. So what's your impact?
What I see is a huge amount of people from around the world that really want that transformation and they really want that change.
We are the improbable manifestation of the most profound creation this magnificent universe has to offer.
Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Now, when it comes to living a purposeful life, so often we hear lofty statements of why that become entangled in a brand strategy or are maybe carelessly thrown around without a real anchor of integrity. And having been in the space for quite some time, this is a pattern that I have seen surface, not all the time, and there are a lot of incredible people out there doing incredible things, but it is a pattern that I have seen emerge. And for this reason, I am utterly in awe of anyone who has shifted outside of the story of purpose in order to truly embody their purpose, to live it, to breathe it when life is good, and also when they are literally on the front line and in the fires of change. Now, today's guest is a woman by the name of Linda Cruz, and she is somebody who has made a clear and conscious decision to make her earthwalk count in every moment of every day. Linda is a frontline humanitarian, leadership expert, and author of Leading on the Frontline, Remarkable Stories and Essential Leadership Lessons from the World's Danger Zones. She is also the founder of an incredible initiative called Race for Good, a global youth league that mobilizes students to engage in high-impact learning and develop practical problem-solving skills as they tackle real-life critical issues. Now, across the course of her career, Linda has worked alongside some of the world's most influential figures. And when I say influential, I'm talking about the Dalai Lama, Sir Richard Branson, and the Prince of Wales. She's also worked with companies such as GSK, Virgin Unite, Cadbury, Rabobank, KPMG, and the list goes on and on. Now, Linda's journey into creating a purposeful life by design began in 1996 when she was a stressed out mum, really working in a job that she hated. She was driving along a motorway in the middle of the night when she suffered temporary blindness. And you can only imagine how terrifying that episode would have been for her. And we do discuss that in the course of the interview today. But it led her to an insight and a poignant question, which was, you know, what is the point of living if life has no point? Determined to make a difference, Linda started a new life. And this was the start of a sometimes scary and lonely adventure, but always an emotionally fulfilling job, teaching skills and bringing aid to war-torn refugees, the poverty-stricken, and to victims of disaster. The essence of Linda's message is what she calls a hand up, not a handout. She would far rather empower people and communities to create sustainable change by leveraging partnerships with groups of highly successful individuals, typically senior executives in global corporations and successful entrepreneurs, taking them to some of the remotest parts of the world where communities struggle to either overcome natural or man-made disasters, or to make the most of their existing resources. The idea is that so much more can be achieved with innovative minds solving problems as opposed to only handing over the dollars. The dollars are also helpful. When I talk about being on the front line of purposeful living, Linda has faced death on more than one occasion, but she has never given up her mission. Her ultimate aim is to inspire others to do what they can. And on that note, I have no doubt that this episode will inspire you to not only reach for your pocket when it feels right to do so in supporting the causes that you are deeply passionate about, but to use your head and to use your heart to be an active participant in the change that you seek in the world. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Linda Cruz, it is such an honour to have you on the DNA of Purpose podcast, beaming all the way in from Norway. Thank you for joining me.
It's a very great pleasure.
Well, look, let's dive in because there's so much I want to ask you about in regards to your extraordinary life. However, as you know, as a starting point, I get to speak with really some of the most purpose-driven people on the planet as a result of this podcast, and I think you are certainly one of those people. And with that in mind, I'm interested to know if there is any one idea, trend, or tool that you've stumbled across recently or that you might have been thinking about that you believe will significantly influence the creation of a better future.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's been bubbling within me for a while, but I believe that our world is obviously volatile, unpredictable, and it causes a lot of stress in our lives. I mean, whether it's going from terrorism to COVID to pandemics to the normal things in our lives.
Yeah.
And I believe that we should be approaching everything, literally everything, with a sense of curiosity and fun. Because our lives are already so stressful. If we are just bombarded with more and more stress and doom and gloom, it repels us. We can only cope with so much. And I believe that this is why that at some point in our conversation today, I'll share a little bit about Race for Good. But part of why I've started to create and facilitate programs that are highly impactful, highly meaningful, but highly fun is because I believe that we need this element to engage us on the human feeling level because we're already up to our eyeballs in heaviness, seriousness, and fear. And we have to actually engage people by using a different method. And that is what I feel is essential.
Look, I love that approach because, you know, as you've just said, we are living in a world of unknown unknowns, to be fair. And that can be scary. But I think if we can approach leaning into the unknown with that sense of fun, it actually empowers us to be more adaptable and innovative human beings.
Yes. Definitely.
Amazing. Definitely. So, Linda, in doing my research for today's interview, I know that there was one pivotal moment in your life that changed everything and that became the catalyst for you to create a more meaningful and a more impactful life. You were driving home from work one evening and out of nowhere lost your ability to see. I'm wondering if you're able to take our listeners back to that fateful evening with a focus on how that experience changed your outlook on who you wanted to be in the world.
Yes, I mean, I was a single mother. I took a job because of necessity and it was money. I knew that my first career was a nurse and I just loved it, but with the unsociable hours and the lack of a good salary at that time, I was pulled to do a job that was much better paid.
And I really didn't like it. Deep down, I knew that it was not good for my soul, for my well-being, for my health. But as many, many people do every single day, you have a real goal. And mine was to ensure my children had all they needed. So I took the job and I did notice that I would, you know, cry myself to sleep or have another glass of wine in a way to just cope. But I still just pushed on through until, of course, I had that horrifying experience of driving home straight after a big sales conference, middle of the night, desperate to get home, of course, stressed, tired, angry, fed up, which was a normal state for me then, and shocking experience of losing my sight while I was driving. Now, you know, we have no idea how these things happen or how we survive it. I don't know how I didn't kill myself. But it was when, of course, when my sight went, I thought it was forever. I didn't think it was temporary at all. And of course, you know, you go through all the stages of absolute terror and fear. And then why me? What have I done wrong? And I'll never see my children again. I'll never work again. I know all this terrible emotion. And then, of course, you become, there's a level of acceptance. I remember sitting there in the car, completely isolated, not knowing what to do. And it was way before mobile phones and all that sort of thing. And I was there just thinking, okay, I promise if my sight comes back, I will find what I was born to do. And it was that moment of, gosh, you know, I am not living a purposeful or happy life at all. And I must do something. I must. And of course, that was the prayer from my soul that if my sight comes back, I will do this. And talking to people and doctors since, of course, I had stress blindness or hysterical blindness, and apparently it's common. But I didn't know that at the time, and I just thought my life was over. But, you know, when you get that second chance, I did start to really reflect on who I was, what I loved to do, what made me feel amazing, because I believe so deeply that our purpose, of course, is always found in those things. And it was just one of those incredible revelations that I just sort of put together like a jigsaw puzzle of all the things I'd done in my life and what really made me happy. And then I just realized it was being on the front line and being a humanitarian. I love to travel. I love helping people. I was a nurse. I'm curious about the world. I'm one of those explorer pioneers, but I also knew that I could use all of my wealth of skills to really make a difference in the world. But it was that moment of going blind while I was driving that actually pushed me into realizing I'd gone way off my path.
Yeah, it's like you had a universal wake-up call. And I have to say it's an interesting pattern I have observed in I'm now up to 100 episodes of this podcast. So in having a lot of conversations about how people have discovered their purpose, you know, sometimes it is a choice, but often it will be a crisis situation like that. And it's an interesting transformation that occurs where, you know, you almost have to go through this cycle of letting go of who you think you should be, or, you know, going through the motions of working the job, even though you're miserable, all the things you just spoke about, and letting go of who you think you should be to become who you really are and to really choose to live that purposeful life and create it in an intentional and intelligent way, which we will talk about your journey more across the course of the podcast, but that's something that you certainly did.
Yeah, and I feel that, you know, the great thing is, of course, the universe will always give us a nudge.
Yeah.
And how open we are to that, to realize that that nudge is really giving us an opportunity to really live our best life. And, you know, and I feel when I look back over my life, I know now that that was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me. And I needed it because I was not paying attention properly to myself or to what I should be doing.
Yeah, I mean, you needed it and the world probably needed you more. So now, Linda, look, as you just mentioned, you've gone through this experience. Now, I know from doing a bit of research, you sold everything you owned to become a frontline humanitarian, and you have pretty much done that for the last two decades. You have immersed yourself in environments where unthinkable tragedies have unfolded. You have lived in war-torn villages and on occasions even had guns held at your head. Now, I feel like there's a big difference between having like a statement of why as opposed to like embodying your mission with every decision you make and every part of who you are. So I'm wondering if you can talk me through the relationship between not only what it means to have a sense of purpose, but also what it means to really have the courage and to make the commitment to 100% embody that purpose. And in your case, even when your life has been at risk.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting and evolving journey that I've had. But I have needed, I believe, because of the choice in my purpose, is that I physically, emotionally, mentally need to be with the people that I am looking to help and uplift. It is impossible for me to be sat back in a safe hotel somewhere where I'm secure when the people I'm trying to help have atrocity going on around them or fear or bombs or whatever is going on. I need to be with them. And that is why I did sell everything I own two decades ago. Because I'm able then to go where I'm needed and to really immerse myself in their world. I remember my dad once saying, well, I'm cutting the grass for you. And I'm like, I've completely detached from that type of attachment in my life. I cannot deal with that regular type of life and what I'm doing. I knew I had to be completely immersed. And equally, it was a way that I could really represent the people, be their voice, because I was going through the same level of fear, of pain, of being very uncomfortable. I mean, often I have no bed, no running water, no electricity. But how can I share or affect meaningful change unless I feel it myself?
And I imagine understand it, like understand the communities you're embedded in, understand the cultures, and from there translate that in order to be able to, you know, in order to be able to get the support you need to fulfill that mission. But I imagine to truly understand those communities, you need to be a part of it.
Well, I believe that 100%. Yeah. And I think it's all about, I believe, and all the programs I've ever run since I started this work are really about getting extreme empathy. So we all talk about wearing the shoes of someone else, and that's how you get the understanding. But I believe that, you know, whether if ultimately we want a happy, content, united, peaceful world, this is the key element that we're missing at the moment. We may have this incredible way, like I'm talking to you in Australia from Europe, and it's always easy. But that is just connectivity. That is not extreme empathy. That is not wearing the shoes of the people. If you come from an Islamic or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or a shamanic or a communist world, we need to be able to appreciate, understand, wear the shoes, not judge, not assume we know what it feels like. And this is another huge commitment I've made to the communities I help, but also the students and the business leaders I work with, because we can only really connect with someone if we deeply wear their shoes. Mm. I do that, of course, after major disasters and in war-torn areas and what have you, because that is the only way I can physically do it. But empathy, understanding, and respect of other people's traditions, ways of life, differences, you only have when you really intentionally go there.
Linda, I'm curious to understand, when you're immersing yourself in these communities, really, as you said, really living the lives of the people that you're helping in order to understand them, like, how do you look after yourself emotionally in that?
That's an interesting question. Mm. I mean, I suppose part of my training as the nurse, and it was very old school nursing when I was trained. Mm. And I remember Matron drilling it into us that whenever we were working on the wards or with patients, she would say to us, "It's not about you, nurse. You are here to serve and contribute. You are here to make a difference. It's not about you." So this is the training I had from when I was 18 years old. Mm. Now, of course, we know that we must be mindful of our physical and emotional state. But I have had the absolute foundation of training of service. Mm. So I am able, although I've had many wobbles as well.
Yeah.
But when I go into a very difficult area, I do not put the spotlight on me. I put the spotlight on the people I am helping. Mm. So if I start to have a wobble, which I do, because often the areas are fearful, dangerous.
And because you're human. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm human. But I tell you, it works every time because the people around me are having a far worse experience than I am.
Yeah.
And of course I have my own internal ways. I'm a very spiritual person. Yeah. I have my own practices that I do that keep me very much in tune with why I'm doing what I do. You can imagine my work is very, it needs to be like that because of the total unpredictability of what I'm doing. But I do find that all I have to do, it's like people say to me, "Do you take a holiday?" And it's like, not really, ever, because what I do is so rewarding and so enriching for myself, of course, because I feel $1 million when you help people, but every single day I can affect change in someone's life. Mm. And because I have chosen to work in the most remote, extreme, difficult areas with what I call the forgotten people, it means that I know if I don't get up in the morning and look and connect to do the work, there's families, there's people that may not get help if I don't go or mobilize my amazing local teams to get there and help. So it is a very purpose-driven, emotional commitment to the people and to the work that I'm doing. Yeah, it's very, very deep. Yeah.
So, Linda, I'm just wondering, can you give our listeners a little bit more context around the communities that you're working within, around the lives of the people that you're helping? Do you have any stories you can share so that our listeners can get a sense of what that life is like?
Well, I think I'll tell you about probably my most pivotal experience, and that was after the Asian tsunami of 2004.
Yeah.
And of course, many of us will remember it was on Boxing Day. And, you know, we all saw on our television screens this 100-foot wave and 250,000 people dead. And I hitting India, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Thailand, and I was working in Uzbekistan at the time. And I remember having one thought, and that was, I have to go immediately. And no contacts there. I'm not a charity, and I'm not a diplomat, so I don't have any sort of contacts or protection. But I knew I had to go. When I arrived in Phuket in Thailand, I just got a taxi and said, please take me to the worst hit area, which at the time was Ban Nam Khem. And it was one of those incredible moments when you saw how the elements, the natural world can really be so powerful. So it looked like a nuclear bomb had gone off. So cars on tops of houses, there were trees, debris everywhere, these huge metal heavy navy boats thrown miles inland. And literally the sea was, you know, still full of dead bodies. I mean, it was just the
kind of comprehend it. Yeah.
Possibly imagine. Yeah. And then on top of that, you have, you know, hot, humid country, the smell of decomposing bodies. And so I went to the largest survivors camp in Ban Nam Khem. It was 5,000 people had been put, Thai people had been put in this camp area. And they had lost everything. They had previously worked in the hotels, which of course had been completely flattened by the wave. And, you know, they'd lost loved ones, their homes, their livelihood. So you can imagine the level of grief, the level of pain, the level of fear. And they're all pushed together with all this huge tented compound. Now, I was previously a nurse, so I went there to the first aid tent and just started to help whatever I could do. Mm. But can you imagine being hit by a washing machine coming at you at 70 miles an hour? I mean, the injuries, the destruction, the pain was terrible.
Yeah. I actually can't imagine it. Like, it's such an extreme situation. It's almost impossible to imagine.
Well, it is. Yeah. And I think, you know, in fact, there was one movie I saw called The Impossible, I think, that was made quite a long time after the tsunami hit. And I was so impressed with how well they did it, because often these Hollywood movies can just say, oh, my God, it wasn't like that at all. But goodness me, they really captured the tsunami in Thailand. And it was, I mean, the level of fear and just all these billboards everywhere with sort of faces of families putting pictures up, find my relative, find my child, you know, the destruction, the chaos. I mean, unbelievable. But, you know, you become incredibly focused and purposeful in those situations because there is so much to do. But it was when a woman came up to me in the first aid tent and said, Linda, take my baby. I can no longer feed her. That all the alarm bells went off because it's fine after an emergency for about 8 weeks to keep feeding, tents, blankets, everything. But after a certain period of time, you must then enable people to take care of themselves. And when this woman said, look, all my money is gone, I've got no resources, please take my baby or she's going to die. And I'm like, right, this is when I really have to get into gear to help with the most pivotal stage. And so I replied to this woman, no, I will not feed your baby, but I promise you, I will help you to feed your own baby. And this was when I knew that I needed to mobilize some of the greatest innovators to really make a difference. And now this is why I work with the private sector and I work with students. But at this time in Thailand, it was with the private sector, went to Bangkok and I said, please, will some of you come with me, you great innovators from the business world, to help me? We've got 5,000 Thai people who lost everything and they need to earn money now. So I went, the four people came with me to the front line. They talked to the people, they looked around, looked at the environment, did their research, and they went back to Bangkok. And a week later, they said to me, Linda, yes, we have found a way we believe that the people could earn money immediately. You know, excited, shocked, delighted, will it work? And then I went, and they said that they'd noticed lining the coast where the wave hit still stood acres of rubber trees. They'd researched rubber. Rubber was viable for the next 10 years as a very profitable business. So, of course, then, but if communities don't want to do it, then it won't work. So
yeah,
I went back down to the village and said, what do you think? Do you want to harvest rubber? And they said, well, our grandparents harvested rubber. But we haven't, because we were, you know, bellboys, gardeners, cleaners in the hotel industry, and we liked that life. But yes, of course, we can harvest rubber. Then the critical thing, how much does it cost to start? Because, you know, is that going to be just too extreme to be able to start? But they'd done their research, the business people, and they said, no, for a cooperative of four families working together, it's just $250. And that was to buy the rubber mangle and the knife and the coconut shell. And so they started immediately. And within 4 months, they were earning three times the amount of money they ever earned in the hotel industry. You know, this is why the magic of innovation, big ideas that the locals wouldn't have thought of, I wouldn't have thought of. And this is why I am so committed to engaging, I believe, the two parts of society that really are not ever included in these big, in solving these big critical issues. And that's the private sector and students. Because we need different perspective. We need the innovators in Google, Facebook, Tesla. So that we need this type of brain, but actually focusing on some of our critical social and environmental issues. And all of my aid career, I've committed to doing this. And actually, I must say, it was because of Prince Charles of England.
I read that story. Yeah, I love that story too.
So I was in a refugee camp just outside of Delhi, and very new aid worker just started in the year 2000. And Prince Charles came to visit a project I was doing in Majnukutila, Tibetan refugee camp. And I was telling him, Your Royal Highness, I'm just so excited. I'm going to just work with the private sector, students, and it's all going to be about a hand up, not a handout, sustainable business solutions. And he said, Linda, promise me one thing, because they'll be so excited by your passion and your determination for this model, and they'll want to give you a lot of money. Do not accept it, he said, unless they engage with their intelligence, innovation, and compassion. Never just take the money. The money is needed, but it's just for the moment. They are the real jewel. So that's what I did. And the whole career, I've never, ever accepted money from any company unless they will engage with their innovation and business skills.
Absolutely. And even for them, I imagine, again, in talking about the experience, the energy of purpose, whatever you want to call it, that they're not going to get that experience without actually being actively involved in the solutions. And as you said, you know, being hands-on and giving people a hand up as opposed to a handout. A handout doesn't give you a sense of purpose. It's when you're on the ground and having that real, you know, human experience of creating those solutions that you're empowered to experience that energy.
Yeah, I mean, it's so true. And that's why I now run this program for students and business leaders called Race for Good. And even through COVID, this pandemic, everything just went online. And the students right across Latin America, Africa, Asia, Middle East, we've all been solving problems online. And the ages are as young as 10 years old. And we have a pledge with Race for Good. Every winning solution, and the judges are the community, the vulnerable community are the judges. Every winning solution is implemented within 2 days. 2 days.
Amazing.
And so the students see with their own eyes the difference they have made.
Yeah.
To another family that they are accountable for on the other side of the world that have just been involved in an earthquake or in a very difficult situation. People cry with joy because they, at 10 years old, 15 years old, 18 years old, have left a legacy and transformed a family's life, and they see it within 2 days.
Yeah, beautiful.
So even with COVID, the teams are in those communities And so we have actually impacted more lives during being online with COVID than before COVID. So unbelievably. But when you talk about that true sense of purpose and contribution, contribution is the greatest human need. When I was working with KPMG in Thailand after the tsunami, they did did some research on productivity. So they gave their people in Bangkok a day off a month for 6 months to help on the front line. And they would come down with us and work and help with their marketing skills and all their business skills. At the end of 6 months, the global chair came and thanked the employees for their service. And he said, but the incredible byproduct was this: during that 6 months that you were of service, one day a month, so you worked less hours, our productivity went up.
Wow.
Contribution energizes you. It makes you feel so good that you're giving of yourself, your talents, your compassion, your skills, that you actually are more productive and happier person. So this is why I know, because I work with students and business leaders now globally, and they all say the same thing. And when one race finishes and they're between 3 and 5 weeks, all the students say, give me another family to help. Give me another community to help. And you can imagine that service, but also they're learning global citizenship. They're learning empathy. They're learning what it's like to be a Muslim living in the high desert in the Sahara, or a Buddhist living in the high Himalayan mountains with no electricity, or in 51 degrees heat. Why am I in Norway? We're about to run the Arctic race for good, because I want people to feel what it's like to live within the high Arctic and actually experience the melt. Science is great. The data is great. But we have to feel these things as human beings. And this is what Race for Good does.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely have some more questions to really unpack Race for Good. I think it's an extraordinary movement, really. The thing that I think is wonderful is the timing of Race for Good. I imagine, you know, that we're now in an age where like technology was once a sector on its own, where today it's something that is a layer across all of society. And because of that, you're able to reach nearly every part of the world with Race for Good in order to connect people and to amplify their ability to step into purpose, as you said, sometimes within 2 days. But the other thing I think technology has created is the ability to see what you called the forgotten people before, to actually hear those stories and to understand so much more about the state of the world, and then through Race for Good, be able to actually take action and do something about it. So, you know, I think it's an extraordinary time for this platform.
Yeah, I really believe that we, you know, so much of what's going on in the world disempowers us.
Yeah.
We feel we have no control. But what Race for Good does, it gives you that absolute ability to, sitting in your armchair or sitting in your classroom or sitting in front of your desk, to get in deeply into a meaningful, high-impact situation with people who really need your assistance and innovation. But it's just, it's facilitated in a way that is dynamic, exciting, it's real, but you are accountable. This is not theory. And this is why I think the students that I work with love it so much, is because at school often they are given theory. They're given hypothetical situations where they get such a sense of purpose because this is a real family that they are working with. Real, real, real. And of course, luckily, because of this, you know, because of technology, we're able to do that. And also, I have students talking to each other from Vietnam and Peru and the Philippines, and they have one common purpose: to uplift this family. So you're having all this global connection with one huge spotlight on And can you imagine the sense of gratitude and appreciation these students have once they realise that no iPhone, you know, no TV, no radio, and yet these facts, because poverty doesn't equal unhappiness.
Mm.
These communities, at the end of the day, if they have fed every family member with a bowl of rice, they dance and drum and sing. They are joyous because they have survived that.
And I mean, I just love the fact that the values you're giving these students around, you know, the creation of like diversity by design and collaboration and all of these skills, contribution, as you mentioned before, all of these skills and values that are actually going to serve them for their entire life.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we now start as young as 10 and we're looking to go younger. Because I believe it's something that as the younger the better, as we know that if you want to learn a language, start it at age 5 or 6, you know, you are a sponge for everything. All of these, this empathy and understanding, as well as all of, as you say, the diversity they're coming, if they understand, you know, that what it's like to live in a different environment or from a different religion, a different background, and all that is embedded, we can get away with having to teach diversity and inclusion. It will be a natural thing. They will grow up with that level of understanding and empathy. Mm. Yeah.
So, Linda, I want to lean into the leadership side of this a little bit, because regardless of whether it's Race for Good or whether it's the communities that you're working within, the aid workers you're working alongside, or even the entrepreneurs who are giving their tools or their time to your mission, your job is to lead all of these people towards the promised land, the solution. What is your approach to really facilitating cooperation and or collaboration between these diverse communities or, you know, unlike minds? Do you have a process that enables that to happen in a seamless way?
Well, yeah, you know, of course, I've really learned it over the years. But the key thing is, I mean, regarding the communities, I always go as a lone foreigner. So I never take a posse of people in, like we're coming to rescue and save you.
Yeah.
I am there really to work with on the ground people, with the local people.
Mm.
So I will link with very local people. Often I need a good translator as well, of course. And so, but I don't go to the universities or to the government offices. I will go into the village and find the streetwise salt of the earth people to be my real assistance right at the beginning, because they know the pulse of the village. And these are, as I've said, remote villages which have their own complications around them. And then the key thing is to gain their trust. So that's why when they see someone who is obviously from a very different world, living with them, sleeping with them, eating with them, not washing for 10 days, not worrying if the food is pretty disgusting or whatever's going on in their world, going to their religious ceremonies, becoming them and really wanting to be part of their world. That is how trust is built up the fastest, because they really see that level of commitment to wanting to help them be better in their own world, not me imposing what I feel is right for their world. Then creating, you know, a good team of village elders, the wise woman, the youth leaders, the women who form their cooperatives, the religious leaders, and they really are the foundation for anything that really works well on the ground. One funny thing that I found over the years, though, who do you think is the most trusted leader in most of these remote communities that I work in? The one person that everyone in the community will always look to. Do you have any idea?
I want to say like the grandma or like the matriarch, but I don't really have any idea. No, I'm taking a guess. So.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The wise women are the ones that everyone turns to. But actually as well, the one that everyone has complete trust in is the teacher, the school teacher.
Yeah.
And that always amazed me at the beginning. So it's like they're held in such high respect and if we need to select, say, the first 10 families we're going to help, it's the teacher that has everyone's trust to say, these are the most vulnerable that we'll start with, and then we will broaden it out to other people. So I always work with the teacher. And then, of course, it's always in this collaborative discussion of what we're doing, how we're doing it. But that's how I can really affect fast change, is very quickly just immersing myself and gaining their trust that it's actually, I am there for them. Even when I've been in the most dangerous places in the world, I'm not a threat to them ever. You know, I wear their clothes. If I'm for example, in Pakistan, I wear a complete burqa. I want to become one of them at the deepest level.
Yeah.
And I gain a lot of respect because of that. And also I stay safe because of that.
Yeah. Well, you become a part of the tribe.
Yeah, completely. And you're not that add-on. And, you know, as well, the great thing about being a leader in one of these, in these situations, is knowing that when you're having your wobble, which of course I do, because these are very difficult situations I'm in, you know the skills of the local people around you, and you know the ones that you, that will step up when you're having a wobble. I remember being in Nepal and after the earthquake, and I was on this steep mountainside, and the jeep stopped and everyone said, get out, Linda, we can't go any further, there's a landslide. And I said, well, how are we going to get to the village? And they said, we've got to walk, and we've got to walk across that extremely steep mountain with all the rubble coming down it and all the scree. I said, I can't do it. I started to cry. I was fearful, I just couldn't do it. And the local team and people that I built up just calmed me down. They took over, they stepped up and said, look, Linda, you're on our, in our world, our patch, trust us like we trust you. Don't look down, take one step, then stop, take two steps, then stop. And they talked me through a whole process. And through all my fear, when I really didn't feel I could do it, I remember this wonderful guy saying to me, okay, Linda, I know this is the most scary time of your life, but just think of the smiles of those children when you reach there.
Yeah.
And if you don't get there, they don't get the help. And of course, finally, through all the tears and fear and panic, I did it and I got there.
Yeah.
But that's another part of how the leadership works within these communities, is that, of course, I'm not Superman. I'm not Superwoman. I cannot do it all. And so it's brilliant to see all the other team members able to shine and do their bit throughout the whole process when I'm there. Yeah.
And look, in hearing you talk, there is such a sense of humility in that approach to leadership. I mean, I kind of reflect upon some of the more Western paradigms around what the leader represents and the hierarchy and just the Western society, this whole idea of, you know, work harder, get the pay rise, get the promotion, and you're forever climbing up this mountain. And in many cases, probably keep climbing until you end up burnt out, or you have that tap on the shoulder, similar to your story, where it's like, are you gonna get off this treadmill? Where what you're talking about here is a more symbiotic approach to leadership. It's about belonging and building trust from that space, and the humility of as you've said, being in service to that system and being a part of that, and everybody having each other's back. It's just such a beautiful approach to leadership that is, and one that truly, the essence of it is to belong and to be a part of something, as opposed to climbing a mountain to become the leader standing on top of the hill, which I do think we see in Western ideology so much more.
I agree. And it's care. When people know you deeply, deeply care about them, they also deeply care about you. And it's taking that time to have emotional connection. The work that I do, whether it's with students, business leaders, on the front line with community, and I do a lot of leadership training now with big companies all the way around the world. But the piece often that is missing is this emotional intelligence, the real deep level of care and concern, and taking time to put that part into every part of your conversation, your meeting, your day. If you don't, you know, literally people will not care about you unless you care about them. Mm. And then people, you see, if people know you care, then they are not frightened about being silly or saying something so innovative it sounds crazy. They will be quiet. They will not tell you when they fail, or because they don't feel you really have their back. You don't really care about them. Mm. So trust and care and empathy is, I believe, in all leadership areas is pivotal, and also essentially showing your vulnerability, showing that you wobble, that you feel uncertain, that you cry, that you don't know it all, that you're not perfect. Mm. And I think that, again, allows other people to say, I've got you, Linda. You know, let us do this. This is not the thing you're brilliant at. We are. Mm. And let them rise up and shine. And I see it in all the areas I work in the communities, in the developing countries, as well as in our privileged communities.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and the other thing that's dropping in for me in hearing you speak and hearing your stories is around the whole idea of really listening, like deep listening, not just hearing, not just being in an exchange of dialogue, but to truly understand those people, to actually get out of your own way and listen, opposed to just hearing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, none of my work would actually be successful at all unless we do that. So it is the greatest thing that we must do immediately, because it's all about observing and observing with all of your senses and listening with all of your senses. Because, you know, often we do so much assume or we're in our own groove that we do not see things. You know, I do see our glasses get dirty. We don't, we have so many filters that we must truly keep. If we see we come to a conclusion very quickly, start to challenge that within yourself, because it's often a program that you've got that you think this is right or this is wrong or this should or shouldn't happen. I'll tell a quick funny story of when I was in Kenya. And I was doing an on-the-ground Race for Good, and I had this whole group come with me, and we were in one of the African tribes, and we'd come to see how we could innovate and help. And we had this wonderful tribal leader telling us all about the community, and they'd all gathered. We had the men standing in a semicircle, and behind them were the women. We were a group of five foreigners, and there was one of the American guys in the group. As this tribal leader was talking to us, was saying, Linda, I've got it, I've got it, I've got it. I know what they need. They need a water pump. And the tribal leader wouldn't stop talking. He carried on. And my friend kept sort of saying this to me in my ear. But as he was saying it, of course, the community could hear. And I could see on the women's faces, it was like they were not amused. I mean, they didn't. Every time he shouted water pump, they were like looking very disgruntled. And in the end, the team moved on, and I stayed behind and I talked to these women, and I said, obviously, you know, my friend said, talked about the water pump. This is something you don't want. Why not? You know, we obviously, you don't have any water in the village. This is terrible, because I was looking through my eyes as a Western woman. Mm. And they said, look, Linda, we have... You'll see our mud huts around us. We build these. This is the woman's job. We take care of the children. We cook, we clean, we grow the vegetables. We love walking to get our water. We take a picnic. We meet our girlfriends. We meet our boyfriends. Please, please, please do not put a water pump in the middle of the village. You see, if I had just looked from my own perspective and not listened and not observed, we would have really made a big mistake. Mm. And so... that's a key thing that I teach always, is listening and feeling the energy of where you are. So using all your senses. Mm. Yeah.
Absolutely. And listening at that level really informs a much broader perspective of the solutions you're providing. I love that story. While we're on the subject of perspective, really, at Future Crunch, which, as you know, this podcast is a part of Future Crunch, the essence of what we are about is something that we call intelligent optimism. And this is a lens by which we view the world around us and also within us. At this point in time, as we already discussed, there's, of course, you know, some dark things happening in the world and there are things that are in collapse. But at the same time, there are also extraordinary stories of human progress everywhere if we choose to seek out and hopefully share those stories. And that's really what intelligent optimism is all about. And so I'm interested to understand how you harness that mindset because, I mean, at the beginning of today's conversation, you spoke about the importance of fun. I think in another video I watched, you said that when you went through your turning point moment, losing your eyesight, one of the decisions you made was that everything in your life was going to be fundamentally positive. So how do you harness that mindset in the work that you do? And, you know, particularly when you are dealing with more challenging situations, how do you go about going, you know what, I am going to choose to see the renewal in the world?
Yeah, I mean, no doubt that pivotal moment did transform my whole way of thinking. I mean, yeah. I was a very miserable, unhappy person before it. And I started to study, literally I studied, you know, all the self-help books about the energy of emotion, of words, of mindset. And it was critical for me to realize that actually I am the driver of my own life. Yeah. I will never point the finger at anyone saying, I blame you for me being unhappy. It's your fault. Because actually we have complete control over the way we approach our lives and our mindset and where we put our thought and our feeling and our action. And I think it's a daily practice. I still do it right today, every single day, that I choose where my attention is and what I put my attention on. And life goes better when you choose to actually take the reality. And as you say, I'm in the most difficult situations, but also then once knowing the reality, you look to see how you can take it or be that person to put a hopeful layer of what is happening. Because, and I have seen, you know, when I worked in the Burmese camps, there were these landmine, my mentors, I tell you, my teachers come out of every corner every day. This guy who'd crossed from Burma to Thailand got blown up by landmines. But the joy he had because he survived, right? He had another day of life. Now, what he could have easily gone down into the poor me, I've lost my sight, my leg, my arm, which he had. No, he went into I am alive.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying to me, Linda, nice to see you. And he was blind. And it was, you know, this is his decision to take that approach to life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I do have, I tell you, my teachers are with me every day and around me in that way, in such a humble way. And I believe that in our privileged worlds, it's harder for us to be that mindful person on where our mindset is. It's so easy to go, pity me, you know, I don't have the yacht, the big house, the
Gucci going to the bag. Comparison trap. Yeah.
That's terrible. And I think, but I have trained myself very, very intentionally to literally wake up every morning with gratitude, literally look for the good things in life in every single situation I have. So if I have a half bowl of rice, it's thank you, I've had this rice. You know, I think living with that attitude of gratitude is essential to being the happiest and content we possibly can be.
Absolutely.
But it is a discipline, and I really do it every single day. I wake up before I go to bed. I think of all the amazing things that have happened, and I'm thankful for it.
Yeah.
I also promise and commit to doing more the next day. And paying it forward is my big thing. I love that. Random acts of kindness.
They're the best. Because
everyone is struggling. Yeah. Everyone has problems. You know, you cannot find one person in the world, however rich or poor, that does not have a problem. Do give that smile, you know, pay for a random cup of coffee, help someone with their suitcase. You know, anything, it doesn't matter, but that will change that person's feeling for that moment, and the ripple effect is huge.
Oh, and it does. The number of times I've had someone smile at me on the street and the feeling you get from that, just because somebody has brought that energy into your world, something that simple.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And, of course, you know, I think we have to remember we are 100% emotional human beings. Mm. People will forget what you say. They'll forget what you do, but they will never forget how you make them feel.
Yeah.
And most of my leadership is around that. It's how you make people feel day in, day out. It's how they can become the best they can be and how you can become the best you can be.
So, Linda, how can we get involved with Race for Good? As you discussed before, you've got Race for Good, which you founded in 2014. And I know in 2020, you also launched the Global Youth League that mobilizes students to engage in high impact learning and develop practical problem solving skills as they tackle real life critical issues. And as you said before, see winning plans implemented pretty much immediately. If we were wanting to get involved, or we've got kids who want to get involved, how do we join this movement of yours?
Well, there's a website, which is theracegood.com, which I'm sure you'll let your listeners know about.
Absolutely.
And register, say where you live, where what your passion is, whether you're a business leader or a student. We are running races constantly. And as I say, this year we've covered the whole world and we're ready to start next year. And we will be running the Arctic Race for Good, which is going to be exceptional for us all to learn about the people and how we can help them adapt to what's happening in their lives. But it's basically, please go to the website and register your interest. Everyone that registers you're all able to get involved. This is a global movement. Wherever you live, whoever is listening to this, whatever your age, whatever your job is, whether you're an engineer, marketing, construction, whether you're a student of 10 years old or 18 years old, please just register your interest and we will ensure that you're able to get involved.
So exciting. And were you intentional about gamifying good? And creating this whole fun experience around it, because it's like it's exciting. Like, I'm like, oh, I want to get involved.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know what? I mean, of course, I you see all the young people these days and older people playing these virtual games on, you know, the iPad, and they are the hero of the game. They're doing things, and I'm like, let's do it with real people and real problems that have a real impact.
Yeah.
There's no need to just play the fantasy games, the virtual games that can be real. And this is what I know the students love, because it is, you know, we are attracted to things that are fun and interesting and curious and challenging. So there's loads. It is a game where you have a mid-race challenge on health and education. There's a leaderboard, you win points. So it absolutely is gamified, but it is real people and real impact where things get implemented immediately. So it's taking the best of gamification into the real world.
Oh, look, I can't wait. Can't wait to dive in. Linda, as my last question today, you are obviously someone who is an incredibly powerful storyteller. And actually, you're a story shower. You walk your talk as much as you share these incredible stories. In looking at that theme, what is the one story that you believe needs to be flipped, evolved, or simply shared to create a more abundant, more beautiful, and hopeful future?
Do you mean one of my stories or a story that's happening in the world?
Yeah, a story happening in the world, like an overarching theme.
Yeah, okay. So basically I would say I believe now it's up to us all not to be charitable, but to be capable. So this whole thing of don't believe that, we've got governments, we've got charities, it's up to them to solve the world's problems. No, it's not. They can only do so much, right? They really can. And actually, some of the best and brightest minds in the world are not in government or charity. They are in the private sector or in universities or in schools. So actually, it's always up to us. As I say, we are the drivers of our lives. We are the drivers of how the planet and people survive in a good way. So don't just hand over responsibility to other people to do it. We are all equally responsible. And this is where I feel the big flip is. And equally, it's, and that's where it takes, if you divide it up between all the people on the planet to be the change they want to see in the world and not delegate it to someone else, we will all be more invested in everything that's happening around us locally, but also globally. So this to me is the biggest flip that we need to have happen. I mean, it's interesting for me now that governments are stopping throwing large amounts of money in a big wadge to another country when it has a big disaster, because the accountability, the effect, the efficacy of where it goes, what it does, is just not often there. So they're looking to be more grassroots. They know it doesn't work. So it is all about being, you know, very capable and committed citizens. And of course, that's why I created Race for Good, because I get so frustrated at seeing that we delegate all this responsibility to people and we can't expect them to be able to solve it all for us. And then we wag our finger and say, why is our world such a mess? We have to be responsible for it.
Well, you were certainly leading the way, Linda Cruz. It has been such a joy to have you as a guest on the DNA of Purpose podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, it's been a real honour. I love coming to your part of the world. I love Australia. So, you know, one day I'll be back soon and see you all. And
oh, please, I would love that.
Well, that would be a joy. And yeah, no, I love your part of the world, I must admit. So, in the meantime, any listeners that want to sign up and be part of this global community, Race for Good, I would be delighted. But huge thanks for this opportunity to talk today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, if you would like updates on upcoming episodes as they are released, in addition to good news posts from the world of science and technology, please follow Future Crunch on social media, or if you care to do so, sign up to our newsletter at futurecrunch.com. You can also download our ebook on what we refer to as the Great Transformation, which is available at our website. And if you have time, please leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast has been produced by the team at Supernova Tribe Studio.